Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, November 9th, 2021. I'm Pat Steele, and my partner at the microphones for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll read state and local news from the Des Moines Register, along with selections from USA Today. Birthdays and announcements come at the top of the hour. We'll continue with news for another 30 minutes, and then we'll change readers. Our second shift will start with the opinion pages. Obituaries will be read at 11 a.m. and 8 p.m., followed by sports. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby and a weather recap. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. IRIS provides our 24/7 services and equipment to our listeners at no cost. If you would like to learn more about how you can help us keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong, give us a call at 515-243-6833 or visit iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Weather for today, we're expecting periods of clouds and sunshine, winds out of the northeast around 7 to 14 miles an hour, turning cloudy tonight, and winds this evening will be around 48 miles an hour out of the east. Today's high is expected to be 60 degrees, now low at 43. Tomorrow, we're looking at cloudy, chance of rain in the afternoon, a high of 56 and a low of 39. And Thursday, again, cloudy skies, becoming windier, high on Thursday expected to be 52 and a low of 32. Our normal high for this time of year is a high of 52 and a low of 33. Record high set back in 1999 at 80 degrees, and our record low -4 in 1991. Sun rose today at 6:56 a.m. and it'll set tonight at 5 p.m. Our headlines from the front page of the Des Moines Register: Deere says that some work may shift overseas. Another article, Republicans are bullish over their 2022 hopes. And also from the front page, treasure traditions return. From the metro section, the infrastructure plan recently passed got one vote in Iowa. A diverse slate of applicants fared well in the 2021 elections. And a story on breaking barriers. And now here's Deanna with our first story.
Thank you, Pat. Okay, I'm going to read this good news from the front page. The treasured tradition returns. The beloved holiday event is back after pandemic-forced cancellation in 2020. This is good because we are in Highland Park. In August 2020, the hole left by the cancellation of the Iowa State Fair fresh in their minds, members of the Parks Community Thanksgiving Dinner Committee convened in the driveway of Bob and Carla Iverson, hearts heavy. With COVID-19 pandemic an ongoing and unpredictable threat, they had an impossible decision to make. What would be the fate of the 2020 Parks Community Thanksgiving Dinner? Rain, snow, or shine, residents of Highland Park and Oak Park on Des Moines' north side could expect volunteers to convene at Chuck's Italian American Restaurant every year to prepare and dish out a free holiday meal for all comers. Not once had it been canceled in 36 years. The committee, led by the Iversons, weighed the obvious value of the event, which in 2019 provided nearly 3,700 holiday meals to Des Moines residents, against the potentially deadly consequences of crowding together around 80 volunteers, many elderly, into the close quarters at Chuck's. That risk was too high. Reluctantly, they voted to cancel the 2020 dinner, praying that it would make a comeback in 2021. And it's doing just that. The Parks Community Thanksgiving Dinner Committee has announced that the free holiday meal will return to Chuck's this Thanksgiving, albeit with a few precautionary changes. Thanksgiving meals will be available via delivery and carryout without the usual dine-in service, and all volunteers and organizers will wear masks. Recalling the heaviness of the 2020 cancellation still brings tears to Committee Chair Carla Iverson's eyes. You have so many friends that come in that you see year after year, Iverson said, from diners to volunteers to community members. who stopped by with thoughtful donations like hand-knit scarves. What's now a community tradition for thousands started as a dinner for around 100 people in 1984. Originally led by the three Highland Park area churches, the meal moved to Chuck's in 1992 when the pizza restaurant was under the ownership of Linda Bisignano. Bisignano's beloved status in the community, where the restaurant her family founded has been a 6th Avenue landmark for 65 years, helped the event grow. Even following her death, a few weeks before Thanksgiving in 2013, the dinner went on as planned, the steady stream of donations and volunteers undiminished. That was thanks in large part to Bob Iverson, a volunteer since 1987, who at Bisignano's request stepped up as the dinner committee's head chef and operations manager in 1993. Iverson is a restaurant industry veteran, and under his guidance, the production line became a well-oiled machine, expanding from serving 300 meals each Thanksgiving to an average of 3,500. However, more than three decades of managing major Thanksgiving banquets has taken its toll on Iverson, now 68. In fact, in 2019, he announced he was stepping down from his position. But despite the post-holiday exhaustion to come and an utter disinterest in ever eating turkey again, Iverson will be at Chuck's on November 25th, helping put on the 2021 event. "If I do quit, Bisignano will haunt me," Iverson joked. In reality, he hopes in coming years to be able to pass responsibility to current Chuck's owner, Emily Jones, who used the 2020 hiatus to complete a remodeling of the venerable restaurant, which just reopened for carryout service. This year, volunteers aim to serve 2,500 holiday meals to any Iowans who need one. The endeavor costs around $14,000, but there is no need to show financial need to take home or receive delivery one of the dinners. Many who order meals are elderly or housebound community members, immigrant families hoping to experience an American Thanksgiving, and food insecure households. In past years, some were just folks who wanted to meet people in the community. Each meal includes turkey or ham, mashed potatoes and gravy, green beans, dressing, rolls, and a slice of pie. In typical years, community members donate homemade pies, but out of an abundance of caution, the committee has asked for monetary donations in place of pies this year and will purchase the desserts instead. With a focus on local products, the dinner requires around 850 pounds of ham, 1,400 pounds of turkey cut by hand, 2,640 dinner rolls, and more than 500 pounds of potatoes, about 160 industrial-sized cans of green beans, 49 gallons of gravy, and 850 or so pies pass through the assembly line on Thanksgiving Day. Most years, a heap of cranberries brings a welcome pop of color to the meal, but the committee voted to nix them to ease packaging. "We try to use the highest quality products we can, and our kitchen people are extremely food safe because most of them have been around kitchens for a while," Iverson said. "It's a pretty crazy looking operation when we're in full tilt." Iverson attributes most of the success of the event to the volunteers, whose various tasks include scooping dressing, slicing pies, washing dishes, and delivering meals. New volunteers arrive every year, but many have been at it for countless Thanksgivings. Volunteer Melissa McGriff, age 46, of Altoona, said Chuck's buzzes with excitement of the day, and volunteers are quick to help each other out. McGriff has volunteered on and off since she was a teenager, and now it's an experience she shares with her children. "It's an easy way to give back, and it's fun meeting new people and doing something good for others." And I'll pass this on to Pat then.
Thank you, Dan. That's a good way to start off today's reading. Other front page stories. Deer says some work may shift overseas. Executive says we have to serve our customers. This is an article written by Tyler Jett of the Des Moines Register. A Deer & Company executive said Monday that the manufacturer will be able to shift some production to its overseas sites as the 10,100 employee strike affecting plants in Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas continues. Corey Reed, president of the company's Worldwide Agriculture and Turf Division, told the Des Moines Register that Deer executives still want to reach an agreement with the striking United Auto Workers members, but that company leaders have pulled levers to keep some products flowing since the strike began October 14th. The striking workers represent about 13% of all Deere employees, including workers at plants in Brazil, China, France, Germany, India, and Mexico. Reed said executives routinely consider whether to increase production at foreign factories as part of their normal continuous operations. Sometimes that means bringing parts in from one of those operations from around the world, he said. And by the way, Deere's international factories employ thousands of employees in each of these places, too, that step up and step in and help us continue to deliver the parts and components that we need. When the UAW announced the strike, Deere moved non-union employees into production roles to fill the gaps at factories, including Iowa locations in Ankeny, Davenport, Dubuque, Ottumwa, and Waterloo, its largest single production facility. Those employees include engineers, supervisors, and financial services managers. The company has declined to comment on whether the substitutes have been able to maintain the union workers' level of productivity. Reed did not confirm or deny that Deere will hire outside workers as the strike continues. He said, "If we walk through this and the information that's in front of folks, the deal that's in front of them, doesn't work for them, we have to figure out how we continue to serve our customers going forward. That planning is always ongoing." Reed also declined to confirm or deny a Bloomberg report that Deere dealerships are waiting 3 weeks for parts that the company previously could deliver in 2 or 3 days. He said executives have placed a priority on shipping products specifically for Deere equipment that has suffered breakdowns in the field. He acknowledged, however, that dealerships looking to add parts to their inventory are having to wait longer than usual. A Barclays report based on cell phone location tracking found that Deere actually increased the number of workers at parts fulfillment centers by 60% in the weeks after the strike began, compared to the same period in 2019 and 2020. Meanwhile, the number of workers at Deere's agriculture equipment factories was down 34%, while the number of workers at the construction and forestry plants in Davenport and Dubuque was down 62%, Barclays reported. The drop in workforce at the factories could explain why dealerships are waiting longer for those parts. Reed said, "Some of those parts have to be made. Some of those have to be poured, machined, welded, and we've had our workforce engaged, thousands of people engaged, being able to make sure that we hit every one of those orders that we can." Reed's statements came as some Deere workers organized a picket line outside the company's Moline, Illinois headquarters Monday morning, WQAD-TV reported. Until now, the members have picketed only outside of the factories and warehouses where they worked. UAW International spokesperson Brian Rothenberg declined to comment on the report Monday and said he was not sure when UAW and Deere negotiators will return to the bargaining table. Company spokesperson Jennifer Hartman said last week that the latest contract UAW members rejected was the company's best and final offer. Deere and the UAW began negotiating a new 6-year agreement in August, 2 months before the most recent contract was set to expire. The strike began days after 90% of members turned down the first proposed contract. 2 weeks later, the UAW and Deere reached a second tentative agreement, which would have boosted wages by 10% and enhanced retirement benefits. The company also promised to provide quarterly cost of living adjustments. The union voted down that proposal November 2nd, this time by 55% to 45%. Hartman said last week that the company will appeal directly to members to reconsider. Deere officials were also talking with UAW representatives to better understand why members rejected the deal. The company continues to say it will not increase its monetary offer in any subsequent proposed agreement. But some UAW members have told the Register they continue to believe Deere can, in fact, afford to pay more. The negotiations began as Deere boasted record profits, with executives telling investors in August that the company was on track for a net income of $5.7 billion to $5.9 million, or $5.9 billion in the fiscal year that ended last week, at least 62% above what Deere earned in 2013, its previous record year. CEO John May earned $15.6 million in 2020, up about 160% compared to his 2019 earnings. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. Republicans are bullish over 2022 hopes, but GOP is still navigating around Trump's shadow. Fresh off a strong showing in last week's election, some of the nation's leading Republicans expressed newfound confidence last weekend that they were well-positioned to retake control of Congress next year and ultimately win back the White House. Speaking at the Republican Jewish Coalition's annual leadership meeting in Las Vegas, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, a potential presidential contender in 2024, boasted Democrats were freaking out after losing the Virginia governor's race and nearly falling short in New Jersey. Ronna McDaniel, the chair of the Republican National Committee, called Election Day's strong showing a tsunami and a precursor of really great things to come in 2022. But beneath the bravado coursing through the Grand Palazzo Ballroom at the Venetian Resort, the GOP was still navigating around the shadow of Donald Trump, the former president who plans to play a major role in next year's midterms and may again run for White House in 2024. Virtually everyone who addressed the crowd praised Trump, who also spoke by video. But for the first time since losing the 2020 election, he seemed relegated to the background as others encouraged the party to think about its future. The Republican strength in Virginia and New Jersey last week was fueled by candidates who deliberately kept Trump at arm's length and successfully turned out rural conservatives who make up the former president's base, while also appealing to suburban voters who had abandoned the party in recent years. That could provide a model for GOP success in future elections. But Chris Christie, the former New Jersey governor who may run for president again in 2024, warned that would only happen if GOP leaders, including Trump, focus on the future instead of relitigating the past, including the former president's lie that last year's election was stolen. Republicans have extraordinary opportunities over the next few years, Christie said, but only if they offer voters a plan for tomorrow, not a grievance about yesterday. We can no longer talk about the past and the past elections. No matter where you stand on that issue, no matter where you stand, it is over. And every minute that we spend talking about 2020, he said, was wasting time. The party needs to take our eyes off the rearview mirror and start looking through the windshield again. In an interview after his speech, Christie said he believed Trump's role in the party going forward was completely dependent upon the president's own behavior. If the president... Oh, I'm sorry, my phone rang. Toss that out the door. Okay, now. If the president wants to talk about the future and spend most of his time talking about the future and what he sees next, then I'm sure that he'll be a welcome voice in any kind of debate, he said. But if all we're going to do is talk about grievance politics and put out statements saying either you reverse the 2020 election or Republicans shouldn't vote in 22 and 24, I mean, that can't be the leader of our party. It just can't. The RJC event, dubbed the Kosher Cattle Call by its organizers, offered a chance for candidates mulling runs to woo some of the party's biggest and most influential donors on stage and in private forums. Beyond Christie and Cruz, those appearing included former Vice President Mike Pence, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, and the former U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley. Candidates running for Congress and governor also worked the room, including retired football player Herschel Walker, who is running for Senate in Georgia, and New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who was repeatedly urged to launch a campaign for Senate, which he is considering. Let's see. We're sort of the kosher Nostra gatekeepers for those who's running down the road. You have to come here for first and show off your stuff, said former White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, who serves on the group's board of directors. It's really fun to watch potential future candidates strut their stuff to see what they got. They're going to improve. They're going to have to change. It's years away, but this is how candidates get better. But first, some of the attendees stressed came winning next year. A lot of people have come here to audition, noted Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. We have a very rich bench. We have a lot of energetic people. We have resumes that I think would make them qualified to lead this nation. But none of that matters to me until you get 2022 right. With that in mind, some of those eyeing presidential runs made sure to first emphasize the importance of next year's elections. Pence was among those who received the loudest applause as he served as the headlining speaker Saturday night, predicting the country was just 12 months away from a great Republican comeback. He said, "Right here and right now, from this point forward, we will all resolve to do our part to win back the House, the Senate, governorships across the country in 2022. He offered no hints about plans for his own political future, and we're going to win back this country in 2024, he said. Others focused on culture war issues surrounding vaccination mandates and critical race theory, an academic framework that came to dominate the final weeks of the Virginia governor's race. It centers on the idea that racism is systemic in the nation's institutions and that they function to maintain the dominance of white people. In recent months, it has become a catch-all political buzzword for any teaching in schools about race and American history. DeSantis, who proclaimed his state the freest in the country, railed against pandemic restrictions, including mandatory vaccinations, while South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, like others, accused the administration of turning its back on Israel. And they stressed lessons learned from Election Day, including the importance of focusing on issues that voters care about, including education. Virginia was won by parents. Virginia was won by moms, moms who were frustrated, who were outraged at the arrogance and the condescension of Democratic school boards and of a Democratic administration that looks down on them, said Ted Cruz. You just woke up a whole bunch of moms, echoed McDaniel. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Switching now to Metro Iowa section, first story we'll read here is infrastructure plan gets one Iowa vote. Axne is the lone representative from state to support the president's $1.2 billion measure. This is an article written by the Des Moines Register's Brianne Fennestell. U.S. Representative Cindy Axne cheered the passage of a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, calling it the most monumental infrastructure investment this country has seen. Axne, a West Des Moines Democrat, was the only member of Iowa's delegation to the United States House of Representatives to vote for the bill's passage late last week. It previously cleared the U.S. Senate in August, where Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley voted for it, and U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, also Republican, voted against it. The measure is now headed to President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Axne represents Iowa's 3rd congressional district, which includes Des Moines. She told the Des Moines Register in an interview Monday that she was proud to finally vote on a package that is expected to deliver $5 billion to Iowa's infrastructure projects. She said, "I have been in support of moving an infrastructure bill forward since I got to Congress. So to finally deliver on an agenda for Americans and Iowans is a great feeling." According to numbers from Axne's office, Iowa stands to receive $3.4 billion for highway repairs, $432 million to replace and repair bridges, $638 million for water infrastructure improvements, $305 million for public transportation, $120 million for airport infrastructure, and at least $100 million for expanded broadband internet coverage. Though Axne said she believes all the funding is important and necessary, she's most excited to see the broadband investments. She said, "It is time we get everybody connected, and this is what will help Iowa really move into that new market opportunities and educational support, healthcare support, all of the things that broadband can provide in a state like ours." 13 Republicans in the House voted for the legislation, but Republicans broadly were critical of the massive spending package. U.S. Representative Marianette Miller Meeks, who represents the 2nd Congressional District in southeastern Iowa, said in a statement she would have supported legislation funding traditional infrastructure like roads and bridges, but she said she could not vote for the bill Friday because Democrats have tied it to a vote on Biden's Build Back Better plan, a $1.75 trillion proposal that would direct money to help reduce the cost of child care and combat climate change, among other things. She said, "We could have passed a clean infrastructure package already on a bipartisan basis like the Senate did and found reasonable ways to pay for it. Instead, the majority decided to play politics and hold good ideas hostage to push through their agenda in a partisan manner." Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, who represents Iowa's 1st District in northeastern Iowa, expressed similar sentiments. She said, "I strongly support targeted investments in real infrastructure that will improve Iowans' daily lives and keep our economy moving. But I strongly oppose going down Speaker Pelosi's road to wasteful spending and tax hikes." Axne said she plans to vote for the Build Back Better legislation when it advances in the House, and she dismissed Miller Meek's concerns. Axne said, "We've done this in tandem with the Senate all along, knowing that both bills were going to be packaged together. This is not new news," she said. "The expectation was that, yes, we would vote on this infrastructure bill when it was complete, and vote on the Build Back Better Act, because you want to know what? They're both related. They both are infrastructures for our country." Republican U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, who represents the 4th District in northwestern Iowa, said in a tweet that the spending proposals would exacerbate inflation rates across the country. He said, "We're already seeing what reckless spending does to an economy with inflation rising at the fastest pace in 30 years. Families across the country are paying more for gas and groceries. The prices we see today are nothing compared to what we'll see if $4 trillion is injected into the economy." Axne pushed back against concerns of inflation. She said, "I'd ask the average Iowan what they'd say their top three costs are. And I'm going to tell you, I'm out there all the time talking with them. It's housing, it's child care, it's health care. What I can tell you is by lowering the cost in all three of those within this bill, we will address people's pocketbook cost, and that's what they're really concerned about." Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, diverse slate of aspirants fares well. This is elections 2021. Majority of Polk County candidates of color win. Polk County voters had a record number of diverse candidates to choose from on Election Day, with 15 people of color running in mayoral, city council, and school board races across the county. Candidates told the Des Moines Register they ran for numerous reasons. Some were driven to seek election by the racial justice protests following the murder of George Floyd last year. Others expressed the need to provide diverse perspectives in local policy. While the candidates' results were mixed, local races still experienced record turnout for local elections in Polk County, with 21% of registered voters turning out to vote, up from the county's previous high of 17% set in 2019, according to WOI-TV. How did those votes translate for candidates of color? According to an analysis from Sean Banewski, chairman of the Polk County Democrats, 10 of the 15 candidates of color won their races. In Des Moines, first-time candidate Indira Schumacher unseated two-time Ward 1 incumbent Bill Gray. Schumacher, who ran on a platform of defunding the police, will be the first black woman to sit on the Des Moines City Council in decades. Others included Southeast Polk School Board candidate Whitney Smith McIntosh, Des Moines School Board candidates Maria Alonzo Diaz and Terry Caldwell Johnson, as well as West Des Moines City Council incumbent Renee Hardman, also saw success at the polls. If you look at the numbers on their own, there are now more women elected to city council seats in Polk County. There are more people of color elected than there were before last Tuesday. So it's progress, but not as much as we'd hoped, Banewski said. In a snapshot of the state, the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP chapter reported one member of its leadership team, Anita Rollins, won a seat on the Ames City Council. Two additional members are currently in runoff elections in Cedar Falls and Cedar Rapids. Additionally, Waterloo voters reelected Mayor Quentin Hart, who is black, despite opposition from a political action committee that opposed his reelection and instead supported pro-law enforcement candidates. Voters there also elected four city council members, three of them black newcomers, who ran against the PAC's favorite candidates, giving the city council a black majority for the first time. And West Liberty in Muscatine County elected what many believe to be Iowa's first city council to have a majority of Latino members. Although not all of the candidates of color won their races on election night, some are calling the experience valuable as they gear up to run again in the future. Voters in Ankeny passed on electing Michael Moore, who would have been the city's first black mayor. But Moore says he's not discouraged. In fact, he plans to run again. Moore, who received about 40% of the votes, told the Register that as the first-time candidate, he was proud of the number of votes that he was able to garner on November 2nd. He said he was especially proud of his turnout numbers considering his opponent, Mark Holm, raised more than double the contributions. For a first shout-out, it's not too bad. I may be good at this, Moore said. It's encouraged me to sharpen my tools a little bit and build a better team around me and go for it. I will run again. Originally, Moore was inspired to run for office after becoming more involved in the community following Floyd's murder. At first, he was worried about the negative comments he might receive as a candidate of color, but said he's been very blessed with the support he's received. As people are like, "Oh, I'm sorry you didn't win. Stay strong." I asked if they would vote for me again, and they said, "Yes," Moore said. "That's the true words of encouragement that I needed." Other first-timers, like Des Moines City Council candidate Justin Lewis and Ankeny City Council candidate Bill Liu, shared similar sentiments, expressing content at the number of votes that each received, along with interest in running again in the future. I should say, expressing content, there you go, that didn't make sense, at the number of votes they received. Lewis, an at-large candidate for the Des Moines City Council, received about 45% of the vote, laying down what Lewis called a strong foundation. "I'm happy we got a good base and infrastructure. What I plan to do is continue to show up and continue to go to meetings and meet with folks and look at other ways that I can get involved," he said. Will he run for office again? Yes, but he wasn't ready to say for what political office, saying anything is on the table. Liu, who ran for one of two open seats on Ankeny City Council, wanted to be elected to the council as a trusted neighbor that people are comfortable approaching with their issues. Liu, who was born in Shanghai before moving to the U.S. as a child, would have been the first person of color elected to the council. He received almost 23% of the vote, finishing third among four candidates, which he called pretty amazing. Now that Liu, who currently works as an officer with the Des Moines Police Department, is moving to dayside hours at his job, he says he will be able to commit even more time to volunteering and being active in the community, all in anticipation of running again for city council. "This first year was just my getting my feet wet and learning. It was really good to be part of that experience and know the kind of in and outs of how it goes," Lou said. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Another story from the front page of the Metro Iowa is Breaking Barriers. A woman finds global voice acting success from Des Moines home. This is an article written by Andrea May Sahori of the Des Moines Register. Jessica Trinidad fell in love with the art of the voice while listening to the radio novela Porfirio Cadena in Mexico with her grandfather, Albiluto Hilario. It was a cowboy radio novel with a Robin Hood-type character that would steal from the rich and give back to the poor, Trinidad said. It was her favorite, and it became hers too, as she listened to sound effects of shootouts and horses' hooves. It was incredible how the show made your mind wander just by using voice, just by using sound effects, Trinidad, age 38, said. She's dyslexic, so listening to Porfirio Cadena gave her stories that would have been a struggle to read. It would make you feel like you were there, she said. That was before Trinidad moved to California in 1995 and eventually made her way to Iowa in 2000. Fast forward to 2021, and Trinidad has become an award-winning voice actress. She has starred in her own company, Jessicat Productions. Her voice is in 4 national campaigns, and she's voiced for brands like Pandora and McDonald's. But her success as an international bilingual voice actress didn't come easy. Trinidad was first introduced to the business of voice acting when she was in high school in California. A teacher, who was a voice actor, noticed her impersonating characters from Mexican soap operas, she said. He invited her to do 2 commercials for a radio station, which she did for $20 each. Trinidad said, "I fell in love with it." Soon after, she moved to Iowa. The dream of becoming a voice actress was tucked away, but stayed in the back of her mind. Then in 2009, after 10 years of working 9-to-5 jobs, Trinidad was driving on Bell Avenue on Des Moines' south side and thinking she wasn't happy at all. She said to herself, "I'm just going to do it." Trinidad looked up the English word for voice acting and quickly found a coach in New York City with whom she visited in the winter of 2009 to create her first demo. Her coach and others in the business she would soon meet told her she needed to be in major market to make it, like Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. Trinidad said, "If you tell me I can't do it, I'm going to find a way to do it." She created a home studio in Des Moines and found her first gig on Craigslist, creating audio instructions for a nursing home. She continued to work the business by networking and attending conferences. And by 2014, she quit her 9-to-5 job and accomplished her first national campaign for mega bus advertising, $1 trips. Trinidad now has coaches nationwide and internationally, with clients in Spain, Mexico, and the United Kingdom, she said, and has been accepted to some of the nation's top talent agencies for voice acting. More recently, she was chosen to voice Telemundo's bilingual campaign for Hispanic Heritage Month, which she said was huge. And her voice, which she describes as sensual, conversational, authentic, natural, friendly, caring, motherly, relatable, sexy, and sassy in an iHeartRadio campaign, won her a 2021 One Voice Award for Best Female Performance in Radio. Trinidad said, "I love the ability to engage with an audience, to convey a message and bring it to life, to leave a legacy for my children." In October, Trinidad and her 5-year-old son, Simon, were nominated for a Society of Voice Arts and Sciences Award for an outstanding radio public service announcement in Spanish. Trinidad said, "They're like the Grammys in voiceover." Together, she and her son voiced an Iowa public service campaign raising awareness of the dangers of lead in children for the state's Latino community. The national recognition for her work from her Iowa hometown is a thrill. "For me to say I did it from Iowa when people said I wasn't going to make it, it was huge," Trinidad said. Deanna?
Thanks, Pat. I think we're voice actors, aren't we? This article is, "The judge says a school district not liable for teachers' actions." Des Moines Public Schools cannot be held liable for the actions of a teacher who attempted to proposition a 14-year-old student for sex, a judge has ruled. Mackenzie Johnson, a former Harding Middle School teacher, was charged in May of 2019 with lascivious acts with a child, solicitation, sexual abuse, and disseminating obscene materials to a minor, among other charges. She pleaded guilty and was sentenced in August 2020 to 5 years in prison, of which 4 years were suspended. Tashonda Johnson and Nick Logan, the student's parents, have previously spoken out about the harm to their son and their frustration with Mackenzie Johnson's plea deal and resulting sentence, calling it a slap on the wrist. In March 2020, Tashonda Johnson sued Mackenzie Johnson, as well as Harding principal Joy Lindquist and the school district. The complaint accused Johnson of assault and battery and inflicting emotional distress upon the student, and Lindquist and the district of negligence in supervising Johnson. Lindquist and the district sought summary judgment from the court, arguing that Johnson's actions were outside her scope of employment and that there was no evidence her superiors had missed warning signs that she was behaving inappropriately. Polk County District Court Judge William Kelly granted the request on October 28th, ruling the district and the principal bear no legal responsibility or no legal liability in the case. Phil Roeder, a spokesman for Des Moines Public Schools, said the district is pleased with the court's decision, but otherwise declined to comment. Attorney Alfredo Parrish, who's represented Tashonda Johnson, declined to comment as the case remains pending. Tashonda Johnson argued that her son's declining grades, absences from class, and frequent visits to Mackenzie Johnson's classroom to work on homework should have raised red flags of possible grooming by his teacher. Kelly, though, said there's no evidence of clear warning signs missed by the district or of obvious safeguards or management practices not taken. There were speculative facts advanced by the plaintiffs, but there are no identifiable facts that would trigger the foreseeability of sexual abuse or an inappropriate relationship between the student and defendant Johnson, Kelly wrote. The suit also accused Lindquist of failing to anticipate Johnson's misconduct based on past reprimands and coaching related to paperwork and attendance issues, which Kelly said would not alert a reasonable supervisor to the probability of sexual misconduct and of failing to protect the student from bullying after the accusation became public. The last claim fails because, among other reasons, the student was in high school and was no longer attending Harding by the time the abuse was reported, Kelly said. Lindquist is not automatically responsible for any actions by a third party just because it was committed by a student or teacher against another student, Kelly wrote. Because Lindquist was not negligent, the district was not on the hook for her actions, and all claims against both can be dismissed, the judge said. There is no indication from the record that the defendants failed to monitor students. There is no indication from the record that the defendants failed to detect discernible grooming behavior, Kelly wrote. There was no indication of danger, nor was there any apparent reason provided in the record to begin an investigation while the student was a student at Harding Middle School. Mackenzie Johnson, the former teacher, did not file a motion for summary judgment, and the case against her remains active. A trial is set to begin January 24th. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Our final story from the Des Moines Metro section is a memorial service is set for slain educator. Police say the teacher was killed by two students. This is an article written by Philip Jones of the Des Moines Register. A public prayer service will be held and state flags will be at half staff Tuesday to honor an Iowa teacher who authorities say was killed by two students last week. Fairfield High School Spanish teacher was found November 3rd in Fairfield Chautauqua Park. Nohema Graber, 66, a Fairfield High School Spanish teacher, was last seen walking through the city of Chautauqua Park in Fairfield, detectives said last week. On Thursday, Fairfield High students Willard Noble, Chaden Miller, and Jeremy Everett Goodell, both 16, were charged with first-degree murder and first-degree conspiracy to commit murder. Governor Kim Reynolds said in a statement ordering flags in Iowa to be lowered to half staff on Tuesday, said, "My heart goes out to the family, friends, colleagues, and students that are dealing with this tragic murder of Nohema Graber. Ms. Graber touched countless lives, children's lives, through her work as an educator across her state by sharing her passion of foreign language." The public prayer service and vigil will be at 7 p.m. Tuesday night at Fairfield High School, according to Graber's obituary. The family will hold a private service later. Hundreds of people remembered her Friday at a candlelight vigil. Nohema lived for her children, her family, and her faith. Her next priorities were her job as a teacher and the students she taught, her parish, and the Latin community in Fairfield, her obituary said. She also enjoyed reading and was an avid walker at Chautauqua Park. Nohema was very disciplined at getting her walking in each day and just loved being outside enjoying nature. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, in an article from the money section that was from last Wednesday, okay. Drugstores turn away walk-in flu shots due to staff shortages. When Sarah Tuttle visited a Rite Aid with her 7 and 14-year-old children, she figured they'd be able to get walk-in flu shots, as they always have. Not this time, she could tell by the pharmacy worker's expression. She looked at me with this totally harried face and said, "We're not doing walk-ins," Tuttle said of the employee she encountered in Seattle. People peeled out of the line. It was clearly not just us. Tuttle and others are running into an unexpected side effect of the pandemic: walk-ins turned away because of staff shortages at pharmacies. Pharmacies are struggling to find workers, much like restaurants, retailers, and other employers facing labor shortages as the pandemic drags on. Among independent pharmacists, nearly 9 in 10 can't find pharmacy technicians, and nearly 6 in 10 can't find front-end employees to run the cash register, track inventory, and manage other basic store operations, according to a survey conducted in May by the National Community Pharmacist Association. As a result, drugstores are falling behind on flu shots. About 11.5 million adults got a flu shot at a pharmacy through October 9th. That's down 34% from 17.4 million during the same period in 2020, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Doctors' offices do a better job keeping pace. The number of flu shots administered at those locations was 7 million, down 13% from 2020. With fewer pharmacists and technicians, some pharmacies say no to people walking in for flu shots. They've shortened their hours to fill prescriptions since they don't have enough people to run the pharmacy. This flu season could strain hospitals dealing with COVID-19 patients. Experts fear that the flu season would be worse than usual, since most people don't have any immunity from the winter of 2020 to 2021, when seasonal influenza virtually disappeared amid social distancing and mask wearing. Pharmacists and drugstore chains also deal with a huge increase in duties, including coronavirus tests, vaccine shots, and boosters. The nation had about 315,000 pharmacists and 415,000 pharmacy technicians as of May 2020, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Both positions are empowered to administer flu shots. Like most pharmacies and retailers, Rite Aid is experiencing some staffing challenges in different regions, spokesman Brad Ducey said in an email. Our pharmacy teams are working hard to address high demand for COVID-19 and testing amid vaccines and testing amid the nationwide labor shortage. As a result, customers may experience slightly longer wait times for vaccinations. He said appointments are recommended to limit wait times, but we continue to accommodate walk-in appointments for flu shots at all Rite Aid stores. USA Today documented instances of other stores turning away patients for walk-in flu shots, including the nation's two largest drugstore chains, CVS and Walgreens. when Tuttle's Rite Aid turned her away, her husband called the Fred Meyer Store's pharmacy. Appointments were required, and none was available for several days. They called Walgreens. Appointments were required, and none was available for several days. Finally, while visiting a CVS, they used the chain's app to make an appointment in the store. Then they got their pokes. But not before the person ahead of them in the line was turned away. "It was startling," said Tuttle. He's aged 44. "I was just like, I can't wait 5 more minutes if that means you can vaccinate this lady." A locally owned drugstores. Pharmacist owners often need to work more hours to fill the staffing void in the industry, said Doug Hoey, who is a pharmacist and CEO of the NCPA. "Some work up to 70 hours a week," he estimated, in part because of the extra demands of administering COVID-19 shots and coronavirus tests. "The workload at the pharmacies is greater. We could use more help." Large chains have hired additional employees, paying them more, but there's only so much they can do, said Mike Johnson, CEO and founder of the National Pharmacy Technicians Association. "There's not the supply available to meet the demand right now. The situation we're in right now, there's not enough money you can throw at this problem." He acknowledged there's a bigger emphasis on scheduling appointments this year. "It's not required by most of our members, but it's very helpful if the patient schedules their appointment. Research suggests that patients are unlikely to make an appointment to get a flu shot without someone proactively scheduling it for them. A Rutgers University study in 2017 showed that only 5% of patients in a medical practice made an appointment to get one on their own. Elizabeth Arnold, a traveling nurse based on the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but working at a hospital in Charlottesville, Virginia, didn't schedule a flu shot after she decided to get it. She's required to be vaccinated for her job. She planned to get inoculated on her off day when she was turned away for a walk-in flu shot at a CVS pharmacy inside a Target store. "There was nobody there," she said. "The gal was like, 'Yeah, no, you have to have an appointment.' I was like, 'Please, can't we just do this really quick? We could have had this done already when we started the conversation.' She was like, 'No, sorry.' The next available appointment, 2 days later. She ended up scheduling a shot when she was back home in Texas for a brief stint. 'I couldn't believe it,' she said. 'They shouldn't have an announcement at the door saying flu shots are available. They're free. Would you like your flu shot today?' She said she's concerned that people who aren't determined to get a flu shot won't try a second time if they're turned away. 'Someone is not going to take time out of their day for a 10-minute slot and go all the way up to the store to get it done. They're just not going to do it.'" CVS spokesman Joe Good said the company recommends making an appointment for vaccines. "If it turns out there isn't an appointment available, the CVS pharmacy staff can help assist the patient in finding an available appointment at another local pharmacy or another day, depending on availability," he said. He acknowledged that the company faces a tight retail labor market that may result in minor staffing issues and minimal service disruptions. CVS, he said, has moved to deploy teams to support stores that are understaffed and made decisions about hours and workflow process while raising wages and implementing technology to smooth operations. "Pharmacies are not crying wolf," said Aaron Sundaram, a corporate analyst at CFRA Research, who has studied Walgreens and Rite Aid. "They genuinely lack staff as they face increased workloads. The labor issue in pharmacies is exacerbated by the fact that these pharmacies have been given little to no lead time in our response to fighting this pandemic. For example," he said, "the federal government authorized COVID-19 boosters shots for certain Americans. Drugstores handle a great share of those shots, and they did in the early going on of the vaccine rollout and when public health departments played a greater role. These pharmacists, these pharmacy techs, they're voicing the same concerns of all other industries. They've been working day in, day out since the pandemic started. They want better pay. They want better benefits." CVS and Walgreens announced plans to raise their starting wages to $15 an hour. That would help them attract more cashiers, alleviating pressure on pharmacists and technicians to help customers check out. Walgreens offered a single assigning bonus of up to $1,250 for full or part-time pharmacy technicians through the end of October to help support the administration of vaccines, coronavirus tests, and other pharmacy duties. It created a position, pharmacy operations manager, to lead technicians and improve workflow. At Walgreens, for the best experience, customers are encouraged to make appointments for flu shots and other vaccines, including COVID-19. In some cases, Walgreens pharmacies may reduce their hours because of staffing challenges. Our store team will direct customers as appropriate to the nearest Walgreens for their prescription needs, care, and support to help ensure continuity for our patients. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Continuing also from the money section of USA Today, some state economies are above pre-pandemic levels and others lag. After a rough patch marked by a surge in COVID-19 cases, the U.S. economy seems to be firmly back on the road to recovery, with Moody's Analytics Back to Normal Index reaching a new pandemic high in October. More evidence came Friday as the Labor Department reported employers added a better-than-expected 531,000 jobs last month. Some states, however, are closer to their pre-crisis level of activity than others. More rural states with lots of open spaces in the South and West that impose fewer restrictions have approached or topped their pre-COVID-19 peaks. They're ahead of more cautious, densely populated states like New York and California. Some of these more conservative states also rely heavily on tourism or the revival of downtown restaurants and shops and bustling urban centers for their economic lifeblood. They're still struggling to reignite their financial firepower as most professionals continue to work from home either full-time or at least a couple days a week. The dynamics have left states like South Dakota and Idaho near the top of Moody's Back to Normal rankings and New York and Illinois at the bottom. But some of those more crowded states also boast the highest vaccination rates and were less impacted by the summer COVID-19 surge sparked by the Delta variant, says Moody's economist Matt Coyer. As a result, they've made the biggest strides in recent months, narrowing the gap with states that reopened more aggressively. The vaccine made states more resilient, Coyer says. The index is made up of a variety of economic gauges, some in nearly real time, that measure how much states have recovered in each category, including open table restaurant reservations, Google Mobility, which tracks where people are moving about, from shops and sports arenas to offices, employment, and hours worked. Here's a look at the five states that are closest to or above their pre-pandemic benchmarks and the five that have the farthest to go. Top five in order: South Dakota, 3.4% above pre-pandemic economic activity. One of the most geographically dispersed states, South Dakota is home to many ranchers and a large Native American population. State officials never imposed lockdowns or business closures during the depths of the health crisis, and the state became known for the Sturgis motorcycle rally in August that led to massive COVID-19 spikes. Rhode Island, 1.4% above pre-COVID-19 level. The small state is an outlier among a cluster of densely populated northeastern states that rank low in Moody's index. It's number two in open table restaurant reservations and third in hours worked at small businesses. Number three, Idaho, 0.5% above pre-COVID-19 level. The scenic state in the Rocky Mountains, known for its potato crop, is also among the most sparsely populated and doesn't depend on resuscitating lively downtown districts. Number four, Nevada, 0.2% above pre-COVID-19 level. The gambling and entertainment mecca was hammered early in the crisis, putting it in the bottom three or four states, but has made a furious comeback as a result of reopening economy, Collier says. And fifth state above the average is Connecticut, 0.7% below pre-COVID-19 level. The telecommuting movement has given a big boost to the state as New York office workers who live in Connecticut and work from home and patronize local restaurants and shops. It's number two in restaurants. Now, the bottom five states are New York, 14.4% below pre-pandemic level. Illinois, which is 12.5% below its pre-pandemic level. Louisiana, which is 12.1% below its pre-pandemic level. Hawaii, which is 12.1% below its pre-pandemic level. And California, 10.1% below its pre-pandemic level.